The first one to be terminated was the Menominee Indians of Wisconsin. They had millions of prime land, timber, and lakes to make hunting lodges and other things out there. It was beautiful, which they did today. They got it, all those things out there today. But they came and took all that land from them. Then they come here in 1958. Was it 58? Yeah, 58. I was 13 years old then. And they came and told us, we have been terminated and we have to accept it. We were supposed to be the second reservation to be terminated.
The Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa Cree.
Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa Cree, yes. And my father and all of them and their generation, a lot of people left on relocation. They said, it's hopeless. We can't fight these people. They're too powerful. They're just too powerful with... You know, maybe life will be better over there and stuff like this on this relocation. So they picked this city to go to. A lot of them went to Washington State and Oregon. And it was a small group of us stayed here and said, no, we're not leaving. So my dad and his generation said, well, what do you mean been terminated? You can't come here and tell us that we got to leave and you're going to just terminate us as a race of people and tell us that we no longer exist. Go f*** yourself. Come on, let's fight it out. And literally, they were. I was proud of them. I was 13 years old. They stopped all provisions. One little girl died over here from malnutrition, and that's what really got everybody angry.
So they thought they would starve you out.
Yeah, they were making conditions so hard that we were accepting termination. We were leaving. There, a lot of people took it. Well, at least my kids won't starve to death.
And the BIA reversed its decision?
They reversed their decision and gave us $50...
Vouchers
to go buy groceries here in Rolla. Everybody got, the whole reservation got $50.
And they didn't disband the
No, they got the hell out of it because we told them we were going to fight them.
So this was really the beginning of the Red Power movement and the founding of AIM.
Well,
right?
I guess so, and so many real.
The American movement, which you want to rename the
But they were doing that for, I mean, my people have been fighting back for 500 years, Amy.
But the modern day.
Yeah, the modern day stuff. But no, we went to war with them. We went to all kinds of different levels of...
Resistance,
you know.
So talk about the founding of AIM, the American Indian Movement, which you today would like to rename the American Indigenous
Movement. Well, I was involved in a number of different organizations before I joined AIM. And one of the biggest ones that I was, I helped organize the United Tribes of All Indians in Washington State. And we took over Fort Lawton. That one of the treaties that we were pushing them days, our people was older people were pushing this too, but they just passed. All of our knowledge came from traditionalists. That's the policies, the American Indian Movement. We followed there. First of all, people got to understand, the American Indian Movement policy is they can't come onto this reservation and start dictating their policy. They have to be invited by the traditionalists or tribal government or what else. We can't just go onto a reservation and say, you're going to do this, you're going to do that. No, we can't do that, and we don't do that. We have to be invited first. So, anyway, this was before I joined the American Indian Movement. I was involved with the fishing and hunting struggles over there. That was a big area that they really fought hard and got really...
fishing and hunting rights.
Yes, treaty rights. In fact, Marlon Brando got arrested with us in 1955. He got arrested on one of them lakes. I wasn't there, but he got arrested fishing and hunting with the natives out there.
So talk about the occupation of the BIA offices in Washington, moving on to Wounded Knee and Pine Ridge.
Well, it just, our resistance became extremely popular. American Indian movement was growing, and not just here in America, Canada, Central America. So a lot and a lot of full bloods all through Central America, more than people, more than here in the United States. And we were uniting with all of them, all those natives across this country, across this whole continent, I mean. And we were uniting, we were pulling together with the American Indian movement. That's why we became a threat to the government. So, they later on when I was arrested, after I got arrested, this one guy was telling me, he said, yeah, I just went down to Mexico someplace, one of the towns. And he said they were organizing resistance and stuff like this. He said, I was down there visiting him. He said, I went to this old, this guy was told me was he was some kind of medicine man or something. So I went down there and visited him. So I went into his place, into his, he had a kind of a hut-like home, I guess. And he said, what do I see? He said, I see your poster on one of the walls. That's so far back. We went through all that stuff. And
But especially for young people to understand, I mean, you're talking about this critical moment of 1973,
4, and 5. 60s, actually.
What's that?
Started in the 60s, really.
And also the height of the anti-war movement, mm-hmm. and the role and the effect of the anti-war movement on the Native American movement and vice versa. If you can talk about those critical moments.
A lot of us natives were also involved in the peace marches and with the blacks and the anti-war movements and things like that. We were involved in all that stuff too, but we were working on trying to get their support, and they were working on trying to get our support. Then the hippies came out, and the hippies really helped us. The hippies did a lot to help us. They started dressing like natives. They started doing things like native people, and a lot of them came from very, very wealthy families. A lot of people hated them. That's one of the reasons the government hated them, is because they were really pushing the native issues, you know, the culture and stuff like that.
So the Trail of Broken Treaties, that was 1972. Explain what it is, which was a takeoff the Trail of...
We knew that we had to get to... get the government to start honoring our treaties, because they never honored our treaties. And the only way we could do this is to go right straight to Washington. And so we organized a group, we called it the Trail of Broken Treaties, and we all organized from all over the country. They sent representatives in old cars. We had all, nobody had new cars in them days. And we all went to Washington.
You went?
Of course I did. Of course I was there too, yeah.
This is, of course, a takeoff on the Trail of Tears. And most people in our schools, and maybe less so, especially now, will ever even know what the Trail of Tears was.
Right, precisely. That was all past. Everything we did, we called it, well, like the Trail of Broken Treaties, that was done under the Trail of Tears and the Long Walk, all the other events like that that happened. It wasn't just the Trail of Tears. That's what people have to understand. It was the Trail of Tears was just one of them that became so well known, because I think 10,000 people died on that. And they're laying alongside the trails and stuff, from dying from sickness, malnutrition, all that stuff on the Trail of Tears.
This was under President Andrew Jackson.
Yes, yes.
The president who President Trump
revered. Order, yeah. He was a hater, and we organized under basically the same policies of exposing what was done in the past and continued to be done. And we still find it's still happening today, Amy. Ann Coulter had made a public statement that about Native people that we didn't kill enough of them Indians. That's a very dangerous thing to say about anybody, because there's a bunch of nuts out there, like, you know, you take one of them haters and everything, he could end up killing a lot of innocent Natives for just because those type of words. You got a president trying to do away with our treaties. If our treaties go, we go. This is the only thing to prove that we are a sovereign nation and a race of people. And if that goes, we go as a race of people. So it's not, I mean, it's not ending for us. We're still in danger. Yeah, you see it happening in the streets. You know, I mean, right today. Or look at what they're doing in Palestine. Killing women, children, babies, unborn babies. That's what they did to us, man. And here it is, still happening.
So 52 years ago, 1973, the start of the American Indian Movement, 71-day occupation of the village of Wounded Knee on Pine Ridge Reservation, yeah. Occupation helping draw international attention to the plight of Native Americans, the U.S. government responding to the occupation with a full military siege that included armored personnel carriers, F-4 Phantom jets, U.S. Marshals, FBI, state and local enforcement. During the occupation, two Sioux men shot dead by federal agents, and a black civil rights activist, Ray Robinson, went missing. The FBI confirmed in 2014, decades later, that Ray Robinson had been killed during the standoff. Most people don't know about this history.
No.
Maybe they've heard the book, Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee. So can you talk about Pine Ridge and Wounded Knee, for especially for young people who don't know the history?
Well, I was in jail during the beginning of Wounded Knee, but I got out, was about halfway through. Then I went up there and I helped pack in stuff into Wounded Knee, and I stayed out there on the outside forces. After we made all those trips to Washington and all stuff, all those other demonstrations and all those promises, they were going to do this and do that. They were going to investigate everything, all of our acquisitions and all that stuff. And we soon found out, we knew anyway, but we soon found out that it was all a lie. They weren't going to investigate, and they didn't. And so finally, elders and the chiefs made the decision to go to Wounded Knee. AIM had no part in that decision. We cannot go any place in the Indian country and make policies. We can't. That is not us. We can't do that. Now, and we can't go unless we're invited by those people. They just got fed up with so many more false promises and what was happening. They were being terrorized by a group organized by a mercenary group, I might add. They were provided with intelligence, armored person, ammunition, sophisticated weapons, surveillance and stuff like this, automobiles and stuff. And the leader made that admitted that on a national interview. So we know that's all true. They tried to deny it at first, but they called themselves the Guardians of the Oglala Nation. And
the Goons.
The Goons.
Dick Wilson's.
Dick Wilson, all of them. Nixon ordered the 82nd Airborne to go and investigate what's going on down there, and if we were like the government was claiming that we were communists and Marxists and we were being financed by the communists, they were to go out there and wipe us out. when Nixon got the 82nd Airborne involved in it, we filed a lawsuit, and it took us 10 years. But we got all this information out of the files that they had to turn over to us, right? And we found that they had went to the armory and checked out 250,000 rounds of various caliber ammunition, different sophisticated weaponry, armored personnel carriers, and finances and surveillance and stuff like that. See, that was all illegal. And that's how we found out a lot of stuff about what they were doing there, and was all illegal. If it would have been left to Nixon, he was going to wipe us out. But he didn't, because we heard his wife step forward and said, "No, don't you do that."
Now, still going back 50 years, what landed you in jail? I want to go to the words in Democracy Now! In 2003, the occupation of Wounded Knees considered the beginning of what Oglala people refer to as the Reign of Terror from 73 to 76. Over 60 residents killed in this period. Murders went uninvestigated by the FBI, which had jurisdiction. The period culminating in the June 26 shootout, for which Leonard Peltier was imprisoned.
First of all, I don't know who the shooter is. Our shooters. And I wouldn't tell you if I did know. So I'm not going to tell you anything of that area. But I'll tell you, I'll speak on the other issues, because it's public knowledge, and it's been our attempts to continue to expose that stuff. But there were a lot of Native people, traditionalists, whose homes were burned, whose houses were drive-by shootings. People were pulled over and beaten, and some shot, some killed. And those things are literally recordings on this. We got records of all this stuff now. So people can't deny this stuff. The only ones that are denying this is the United States government and the FBI and people like that. But we faced a time called the Reign of Terror, when they were getting away with all this. None of them were getting investigated. A lot of the older people that seen these people identified them, but the FBI still wouldn't investigate. They were able to kill people at random. They were and getting away with it, because they had no fear of being prosecuted. The only fear they had was of us, the American Indian Movement, because we wouldn't take their every chance we got together. We got a confrontation with them, and that's the only fear they had of anything, of any retaliations, any arrests, or anything else.
We're spending the hour with Indigenous elder Leonard Peltier, released to home confinement after nearly 50 years in prison. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with our global broadcast exclusive. We're continuing our conversation with Indigenous leader Leonard Peltier, released to home confinement in February after nearly half a century behind bars. I asked him about his claims that his extradition from Canada and trial were marked by prosecutorial misconduct. Talk about the coerced testimony of Myrtle Pourbaire, who she is.
Who is she?
I know you didn't know her at the time.
Well, I never knew her. Her father was going to come testify at my trial that she had a serious mental problem. And her sister was going to testify that on the day of the shootout, they were sitting there drinking beer, and we got this all on tape. And They were sitting there drinking beer, and they ran out of beer. And they were watching TV, she said. And they decided to make a run off the reservation because it was a dry reservation. No alcohol was allowed there. And so to go buy some more beer, come back and watch some more TV. And they started driving down the road, and all of a sudden a bulletin came over the radio. Big shootout in Ogallala between marshals, FBI, BIA cops, goon squads against the American Indian Movement. So they were over 50 miles away. Finally, Myrtle admitted that she didn't know me. And,
her testimony
in the grand jurors when he got us all indicted
said she was your girlfriend and she had seen
she witnessed oh god
seen this, all of this.
This was when the lawyers came to me in Canada. They said Leonard, we got bad news for you. And I said, yeah, what kind of bad news? And they said, your girlfriend's testifying against you. And I looked at him, I said, my girlfriend? What do you mean, my girlfriend? He said, your girlfriend. And I said, I don't have a girlfriend. I got a wife, two kids.
So talk about James Reynolds, the former U.S. attorney in charge of the prosecution that helped convict you. He later becomes an advocate for your release, stating the prosecution could not prove that you had committed any offense and the conviction was unjust. He wrote to president after president. He himself was appointed by Carter right through to Biden.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, about 10 years ago, James Reynolds started to have a change of heart, I guess. James Reynolds said that there is no evidence Leonard Peltier committed any crimes on that reservation. And that's pretty, he was in charge of everything.
What this ultimately leads to is your imprisonment for 49 years.
Yep.
The majority of your life behind bars, what this institutionalization meant for you, what it meant to be both a prisoner and considered a political prisoner around the world and a symbol of the fight for Native American rights and what happens to you when you engage in it, all of those things.
Well, okay, I've been asked this question quite a bit and it's hard for me to answer, but I think that what really kept me strong was my anger. I was extremely angry about what they did to me and my people. And I'm still very, very angry. And there was no way in hell I was going to get justice. I could have had at least 14 constitutional issues that I should have been released on, at least that many. And I knew I wasn't going to get it. I knew the courts were not going to give it to me. And even the Supreme Court wouldn't refuse to hear my case and stuff like that. But I knew why. You know, I found evidence of them meeting with Judge Haney, and Judge Haney became a strong advocate for my release. But we found evidence. He worked with the FBI, and I felt so much hate and anger, and what they did to Native people in this country, this continent, and that kept me strong. It kept me from. I've been offered numerous times, a few times anyway, that if I accepted responsibility and made statements that everything we've said negative about the United States government, what their past history was and their dealings with our with us as people in the nation, and they would turn me loose. And I refused to do that. I refused to bow down to them, and I still refuse to bow down to them. I'm gonna die with my beliefs. And I just refuse to. To me, it's treason against my nation, my people.
You're a major symbol of indigenous power, not only in the United States, but around the world. Mm-hmm. What does that mean to you?
Well, I hope I can use it to benefit my people. I mean, as I said earlier, we're still in danger. It's not over for us. We don't get to live like the rest of the people in this country, and free, without fear of what would happen to us if we had our treaties taken away from us. We don't get to live like that. We still have to live under that fear of losing our identity, losing our culture, our religion and stuff. Most Americans don't have to worry about that. We do. And so the fight for the struggle still goes on for me. I'm not going to give up. I have not surrendered. I don't want to go back to prison. I heard that Trump was going to try to take away all the of Biden's pardons and everything else like that.
What would you say to young indigenous people? I'm looking behind you at a photograph of, is it a picture of your great-granddaughter?
Yeah, this one right here.
And she's wearing a T-shirt that says strong. How old is she?
She's now 11. We adopted her when she was a little baby. Been taking care of her ever since. And she loves me and thinks I'm the greatest thing in the world. I love her because she is the greatest thing in the world. And she's now a champion fly swimmer. Her plan was if she wins the Olympics, she was going to take those Olympics and say, this is for my grandpa, Leonard Peltier, who they illegally put in prison. This is for him. I said, where'd you come up with that? She won't say that. She just looks at me. Yeah.
You know, we've been covering the climate movement for so many years. We're here in North Dakota covering the standoff at Standing Rock, the Sioux-led, indigenous-led global movement to preserve the environment. And this year, the UN Climate Summit is in just the tip of the rainforest, Belém, in Brazil. And each of these UN climate summits, we see indigenous people, especially young indigenous people, there fighting for the planet. Do you see the voice of indigenous people on the climate movement as hopeful?
We've been talking about this for 250 years, or no, since America was first organized. When we pray and when we, whatever we do, we still talk about Mother Earth and other environment stuff. We haven't stopped. We never will stop. You know, we are still strong environmentalists.
Well, Leonard Peltier, I want to say thank you so much for inviting us into your home. I'm so glad we're not coming to a prison.
Well, so am I.
Indigenous leader Leonard Peltier at his home on the Turtle Mountain Reservation in North Dakota on his 81st birthday weekend. Special thanks to Charina Nadura, Sam Malkoff, Dennis Moynihan, Mike Burke, and to you observant ones, to my pup Zazu, the news hun. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM. SF Youth Community Radio Station, broadcasting live from Burnaby, BC.
If you're a regular listener of this show or other shows on CJSF, we'd love to hear from you. Tell us about what you like and why you like it, as well as ways we can improve our programming. To leave comments, please email cjsfprog@sfu.ca or call 778-782-4423. This information can also be found on our website at www.cjsf.ca.